On Tech News Today, Apple is close to paying $3.2 billion to buy Beats Electronics, a company that makes lousy headphones and an unpopular music service. Plus, California moves closer to passing a smartphone kill switch law, and Apple hires the guy behind the world's best smartphone camera. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, May 9th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Lindsay Turrentine. Lindsay is editor-in-chief for CNET Reviews. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hi.
Glad to have you here. We have big news, of course, talking about Apple and Beats. So why don't we jump right into it? Apple is in talks to buy headphone maker Beats Electronics for $3.2 billion, according to an exclusive at the Financial Times. With us to talk about this is Gordon Kelly, who's a tech journalist for Forbes, and also Casey Newton, who's a senior reporter for The Verge. Welcome to both of you, and we'll just jump right in with you, Casey Newton. Can you describe what Apple appears to be buying? What assets does Beat have that Apple might want?
So they have two big things. One is this very popular line of headphones. Beats Music is said to be bringing in $1 billion a year in revenue, and they're bringing it in at a very high profit margin. They can make those headphones for $14 and sell them for $200, which is very consistent with the kind of profit margins that Apple likes to see in its own hardware. The other thing they're buying is a streaming music service. Apple, of course, pioneered the idea of a 99-cent digital download. But over the past few years, more and more people have been shifting away from that and towards services like Spotify and Pandora. Apple historically has not been great at building its own cloud services. With Beats Music, they are buying a kind of a big head start in building something similar to a Spotify.
And hey, Casey, do you think that this is the end for iTunes? Do you think this is the beginning of the end?
I hope it is the beginning of a beautiful renaissance for iTunes, right? Like ever since we started getting streaming services like Spotify, like Pandora, the vision has been something that would integrate with the MP3s that I already have on my hard drive, with any song that I might want to hear at any given moment without me having to sit through an ad the way I would have to do on YouTube. So iTunes is a very messy, complicated product right now, but man, if they could turn it into something that kind of integrated every song ever recorded, I think it could get really exciting.
And of course, there was a video this morning that emerged showing actor Tyrese Gibson and Dr. Dre bragging about Dr. Dre becoming the first billionaire hip hop artist. And that was good fun. It seemed to be a Heineken fueled affair, and it was quickly pulled down, probably because Apple got them on the phone and said, "What the heck, man? What are you doing?" So, Gordon Kelly, you wrote that buying Beats is a huge mistake for Apple. Why did you say that?
I think it's interesting when you break down what Casey was talking about earlier. There's basically two, maybe three theories about why the purchase has been made. One is it's going to buy a brand. It's going to buy a certain amount of coolness, which is stepping outside of Apple's comfort zone for the first time ever. It's never bought a brand, kept that brand, and required that level of coolness. You know, why does Apple need that level of coolness all of a sudden if it isn't doing the job that it should be doing in the first place with its brand and its identity? The second side of that is the streaming music. Now, why does Apple need to pay $3.2 billion just to, in theory, seal the deal with some record labels? If you look at what the likes of Beats did, they paid $10 million for Moog 2 years ago, and that got them the deal. Why are they needing to pay $3.2 million now? Can they not seal the deal anymore? So there's a question here, which is, if you're going to buy a streaming music service for the deals with the record labels, you could have done a cheaper deal with a relative newcomer than Beats with a proportionally small market share. And if you're going to go after headphones, why do you need the brand cool? And secondly, if you just want to make better headphones, Beats, I think we can say pretty uncontroversially, do not make, in terms of quality, the best headphones on the market. You could have gone to a Shure, a Sennheiser, an ACS, just about anybody in the market, a Grado, and bought them for a fraction of the cost. So, to put this in perspective, you could have bought, say, Spotify and Sennheiser, the two leaders in their brand, while getting rid of competition, and spent maybe $4.5 billion, something like that. It's a very strange purchase.
But don't you think that in buying Sennheiser wouldn't give Apple the immediate profit margins that it probably wants and has grown to expect? And then there is the expectation at Apple that you're just going to go out there and own mindshare, even if it's not entirely owning quality.
Possibly, but Apple has more buying power than Beats. It's a bigger company than Beats. It has more cash flow than Beats. And until 18 months ago, Beats was just simply buying all of its product from Monster. You know, it was just an outsourced thing. There was no technical skill in what Beats was doing. It was just sending it out to somebody else and having it built. So really, Apple, it has a better brand name around the world than Beats does. So why doesn't it just buy Monster, make it direct, do its own product profit margins? It doesn't really need to do that unless, quite frankly, it has a serious cool problem.
Well, and the other part of it is, of course, that Beats owns 64% of the high-priced headphone market. Your point that it's all about branding would suggest that they would keep the brand indefinitely. Hopefully they won't combine brands, call it iBeats. I think that would be a terrible brand. But it sounds to me like they would keep the Beats brand, keep the Beats logo, keep it all, and just, you know, sell it as if it were a different company. As for the music service, I would guess that they would not keep that branding, that they would take whatever there is that's there and use it as part of a relaunched Apple branded service. Does that make sense to you, or do you think they would keep the music service branding as well?
It makes sense to me. I mean, in terms of headphones, again, Apple could have got into this themselves a long, long time ago. I mean, there was a time when it wasn't cool to have red cables. It was cool to have white cables. You know, they've missed the boat on that. Arguably, they're trying to fix it with Beats. Now, they've arguably missed the boat again, having to buy Beats to get into streaming. So this feels not so much like a typical Apple purchase, which is, you know, buy all sorts of cool technology that we don't have. It feels more like a Microsoft purchase, which is we missed something in the market and we're trying to buy our way back in.
Now, Casey Newton, there are reports this morning that music mogul Jimmy Levine, who's the other partner besides Dr. Dre in the Beats company, is going to be working for Apple, going to be leaving some of the companies that he's working at now and becoming some kind of special advisor to Tim Cook. First of all, is there any confirmation of that rumor? And secondly, is that part of this acquisition? Is this partly an acqui-hire to get Jimmy Levine, of all people, into Apple?
That's been reported several places. It's not something that we ourselves have confirmed. I think it's totally foreseeable that Jimmy Iovine could come into Apple in some kind of advisor role. He was close with Steve Jobs and kind of has a long relationship with the company. But it's less clear to me what Jimmy Iovine himself would be bringing to Apple. The most credible suggestion I've seen is that given his long history as a record executive, he could help Apple sort of improve the deals that it already has for some of its existing products like iTunes Radio. So I think that there's some work that could be done there. But I think it's probably generally overstated that this is a $3 billion acqui-hire. Like, let's keep in mind that Beats was making more than $1 billion a year in revenue. They're only being bought for $3 billion roughly. So that's a pretty low multiple in the world of tech when you're buying a company for three times its revenue. So I really think that the core of this, it's kind of two birds with one stone. You get premium hardware that you can sell at a high margin, and you get the foundations for a new streaming service, which the writing is on the wall. That's the way that people are going to be listening to music in the future.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Casey, actually. And I think that if anything, the acqui-hire part of this is just for the relationship with labels. Apple makes more and more of its money through content, and having that relationship, whoa, my lights went out. Having that relationship in LA is going to be really important.
Now, we have a question in the chat room from our own Patrick, who works here at Twit. And the question is, some Windows laptops have Beats audio built in. How fast will they drop this from their machines? I'll throw this to you, Casey Newton.
Well, this is one of the fascinating questions about this purchase, is that Beats is platform agnostic. We've seen Beats everywhere. We've seen it on smartphones. We've seen it on HP products. It's on Windows laptops. You sort of imagine that that's not going to remain the case forever, but it may take a little bit of time to wind down some of these deals. I think the big thing to watch for if and when this announcement gets made is what Apple says about the future of the brand. And frankly, they could say anything. We just don't know.
Okay. Gordon.
You know, for what it's... Oh, sorry. Just really ahead, quickly, Lindsay. For what it's worth, Dan Ackerman here at CNET called up HP to ask them this question, and they said, we don't comment on rumors and speculation, so I suspect they have no idea yet what's going to happen.
Now, the audience of Tech News Today follows the technology industry pretty closely, and it has to be, we have to bring up the degree to which HTC has really been screwed in this deal. So, Gordon Kelly, can you talk a little bit about the boat that they apparently are missing here?
It's quite an incredible boat, in all honesty. A few years ago, HTC bought a 51% stake in, essentially a controlling stake in Beats, and it bought it for roughly $300 million. It sold that back now in two chunks, again, roughly 25% in 2012, 25% towards the end of 2013. And it made, I think it was just over $450 million. So if you're selling, six, seven, 8 months ago, you're selling half of Beats for that amount of money, and all of a sudden it's now going for 3.2, and you're a struggling handset maker who's already, trying to raise money, which was the primary reason for the Beats sale. It's a terrible miss.
Absolutely. And as you pointed out, they could really use the money at this point. Well, Gordon Kelly, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today to talk about Apple's probable acquisition of Beats. You can find Gordon Kelly at GordonKelly.com. That Kelly is spelled K-E-L-L-Y. And also on Twitter at Gordon Kelly. And also, thank you, Casey Newton, for coming on today.
It's my pleasure.
All right. You can find Casey Newton at TheVerge.com and on Twitter at Casey Newton. Well, in just a moment, we're going to talk about the Beats Music service in particular. We talked about the acquisition generally, but I want to drill down into the Beats Music service in some detail. But first, I'm going to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the best place, hands down, to build a website on the internet. It starts with beautiful designs. Squarespace has 25 beautiful templates for you to start with, and then you can customize and modify those to your heart's content until you have the perfect, beautiful, well-designed website, even if you have no design skills at all. It's also easy to use, incredibly easy. But if you have a question, they have live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Plus, there's a completely redesigned customer help site for easier access to self-help articles and video workshops. All subscription plan levels on Squarespace now support e-commerce. So you can sell things on your website, or you can just raise money for your nonprofit or what have you. And of course, Squarespace is mobile ready. So your website, without any effort on your part, will look perfect on a mobile device of any kind. And also you can manage your website from your mobile device. So it's really a great service for mobile computing. Of course, everything is moving to mobile now, so this is very, very important. Start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT, and that'll get you 10% off, and also show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, the Beats Music service is a major factor in Apple's bid to buy Beats. The service has a unique and an interesting set of attributes, and its details are largely unknown by the public. And that's why we brought in two experts who've written extensively about Beats Music. The first is John Paul Titlow, an associate editor at Fastco Labs. Welcome to you, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the other is Andrew Martinique, editor at Android Central. So, Andrew Martinique, can you give us some background on Beats Music? Why did Beats launch? Why did they launch it, and when did they do this?
Well, it's kind of an odd story because the Beats took over a previous streaming service, Moog, which also didn't have very big traction in the market compared to the likes of Pandora and Spotify. And they took over Moog, and they said, "Yeah, sorry, Moog's going away." And then come around January, they said, "All right, we're going to launch our own streaming service." I mean, it was kind of telegraphed. Everybody saw that coming. And then they came out with kind of an interesting model that leveraged their not only their labels and all the deals they have there, but kind of just the star power and the celebrity that they had, to where they could not just give you a big catalog of music, but say, this artist is picking these albums to listen to this week, or, you know, this group is picking, you know, these new tracks that you may not have heard of previously. And that's really the only thing that they leveraged, was kind of their personal recommendations. And that's where they tried to step ahead of kind of the standard algorithm style that Pandora offered, which is really impersonal.
And John Paul Titlow, can you give us some additional examples of what's unique about Beats Music? What differentiates it from the other music services that are out there?
Sure. I think at first glance, it was really two things. One, the design, is really nice and is somewhat different. Spotify has since redesigned and has improved a lot, depending on who you talk to. But then I think the big thing is the curation, as was just mentioned. And this is something that Apple is not particularly well known for. So far, all of its attempts to leverage any kind of social or curation-related stuff with music have been pretty minimal. And all of the other players in this space, which, you know, Apple realizes a need to get into at this point. Clearly, it's where things are headed as downloads flatten. Are focusing on curation. Spotify just bought the Echo Nest. Audio does a pretty decent job, although they now have to find a new way to do it. So, to me, personally, I didn't subscribe. I was already on board with Spotify, so I didn't see a lot of reason to. But in playing around the app, those seem to be kind of the two main differentiators.
So I have a question. How do you think that the integration of the Beats audio service happens, do you think it will completely overwrite iTunes Radio or end up sort of being sucked into the iTunes Radio brand?
So, why don't we throw that question over to you, Andrew Martinique?
Yeah, I would say it's kind of interesting. Beats has such a strong brand in terms of the headphones. But I mean, just looking at app installs across the App Store and Google Play, the likes of Pandora and Spotify and even Google Play Music are still just completely killing Beats in terms of subscriptions. And so it's kind of it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for iTunes Radio's branding to just go away, even though, it hasn't gotten the huge foothold that the other third parties have. I could see Apple taking the idea of all the recommendation engine and kind of leveraging all of those, artist deals that they have, getting their, the nameplates out there to, have a separate section and say, these are what the artists are recommending for you right now. But I just don't see how the Beats brand has a higher draw than iTunes does in the radio space.
And I'm sure it doesn't, but I can imagine with the combination of Jimmy Iovine and Apple and the Beats brand all working together, that a great many celebrities could be convinced to jump on this thing. To what extent is this a social network? And we know that Apple tried and failed with Ping, which is their social music social network. Is this going to be a replacement for Ping? How social is Beats Music?
Now, that was kind of an odd part about Beats Music when it first came out. It said, connect your Facebook and Twitter. We can pull in your contacts. And we're kind of going to do this thing just exactly like Ping tried, where it's a social network, but it's only about music. So you could follow artists on there and it would be kind of like a Twitter stream, except for just about music. We saw Twitter do it with Twitter Music, and, that obviously failed as well. So it didn't work. It didn't work out the same way anybody would have expected for Beats Music. I think people are already a little, they've already so tied themselves into Twitter and Facebook so much, and they each integrate, Facebook integrates with Spotify really well, and people just share anything they want with links to YouTube, links to Spotify and everything through Twitter. This separate social network just for music, it's a recipe that's tried over and over again, and it didn't make sense on Beats Music, and I'm not sure that Apple would be able to leverage it any better than they did with Ping.
How important do you think that music as sort of a concept and a category is for the future of Apple? I mean, it's kind of interesting. I feel like music has become really easy to access regardless, sort of device agnostically, if that makes sense. So does Apple really need all of this?
It's really hard to say, right? I mean, we've all seen the slide in music sales for iTunes, you know, being obviously the biggest in the industry. And it's kind of like, you know, all of these different services, they all have this catalog of, you know, 10 million, 20 million, 40, 50 million songs. It's really hard to find one of these mainstream services that isn't going to, you know, scratch the music itch for everybody that wants to find even the most obscure music. So as you said, it being, you know, it's becoming so device agnostic and platform agnostic that it's kind of interesting to see so much weight put on an acquisition of Beats Music when, you know, everybody seems to be able to make these deals and come up with these recommendations and things like that, that I'm not really sure where the value is coming from, considering that it's kind of getting turned into a commodity at this point.
John Paul Titlow, is there an element of an acqui-hire or a technology buy in this? Does Beats Music have any technology or algorithms or any sort of secret sauce that Apple might benefit from or couldn't create themselves?
That's one of the interesting parts about this, is that it's certainly, you know, it's the, if nothing else, it's the basic infrastructure of a streaming service, but it's hard to imagine that Apple couldn't just build that themselves. You know, in terms of the talent they're bringing on, someone like Jimmy Iovine is obviously very influential within the music industry, which doesn't always have the most, you know, sort of seamless relationship with the tech industry. So I don't see anything technology wise that Apple is getting on the streaming front that they couldn't have just built themselves. I mean, they did just build their own proprietary recommendation. They've had Genius for a long time, and presumably iTunes Radio is based on something like that. And by most accounts, it seems to do a fairly decent job. It's hard to imagine they couldn't build that out further and build some kind of more curated experience in addition to the infrastructure for a streaming service. So personally, I'm having a hard time seeing exactly what they're getting here that they're buying that they couldn't have built, at least on the tech front.
All right. Well, John Paul Titlow, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and telling us about Beats Music this morning. And you can find John Paul Titlow at fastcolabs.com and also on Twitter at John Paul. And also thank you to Andrew Martinique for coming on as well.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk.
Well, I appreciate your stunning video. This is really a great video feed.
You must have a great connection. I can't take too much credit. That's an internet connection helping out there.
Yeah, apparently. It looks beautiful. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
You can find Andrew Martinique at androidcentral.com and also on Twitter at Andrew Martinique. That ends with a K.
Thank you.
Well, Engadget reported this morning that Nokia's senior engineer behind the company's Lumia camera technology has been hired by, you guessed it, Apple. Now, Lindsay Turrentine, this is really exciting news to me. This is, you know, the 41-megapixel Lumia 1020 camera is probably the best smartphone camera in the world, and the person who's largely responsible for this is now going to Apple, which has got some pretty nice phones, in my opinion. It's pretty exciting to me to think of an iPhone with a Lumia-quality camera. What do you think about this acquisition of this person?
Well, I think it's really interesting, and it shows how serious Apple is about catering to people who care about creating. You know, not to oversell it, but for years and years, the thing that's been keeping me on my iPhone, quite frankly, is the camera. I've been quite ready to switch to Windows, but the Lumia cameras are amazing. And to me, the promise of just more and more improvement in the Apple camera is pretty compelling, because it's one of the things that iPhones really have going for them.
I'm kind of interested in the larger story here. We talked about Apple's acquisition of Beats Electronics, I guess it's called, and now this hiring. It sounds to me like Apple's kind of becoming more normal, more like a Silicon Valley company with you know, tens and dozens of billions of dollars to throw around. Traditionally, probably because of the influence of Steve Jobs personally, Apple used to be very reticent to make big acquisitions. And in fact, the Beats Music acquisition, acquisition would be the company's largest in its history. And you heard all of these brilliant journalists. None of us could really figure out why they're doing it. That's really uncharacteristic of Apple. And again, hiring somebody from Nokia with technology is not quite as far away from Apple's traditional way of doing things. But still, it seems to be that the Steve Jobs effect is kind of fading into the background, and Apple is starting to behave more like a normal Silicon Valley, gigantic, wealthy company. What do you think?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things going on simultaneously. One is Apple actually does have a pretty deep history of hiring high-level engineers from other companies. So that's not entirely new. I mean, I think we all know that Apple is facing a tiny bit of a cool crisis. Tim Cook is not Steve Jobs. Nobody is Steve Jobs. And you know, it would be unrealistic to think that there is some genius behind the curtains at Apple who could continue to drive the kind of easy to market products that Steve Jobs could. But I also think that some of the products that Apple is currently selling are reaching the commodity stage. And we've seen this happen with Apple before. Apple trailblazes, say, in, you know, the MP3 player category, really gets the public thinking about those products and using them as a status symbol. And then over time, the price goes down, they start creating products in more colors. And then those products just become sort of standard and less expensive, and Apple has to move on to something else that's big. iPhones are starting to move in that direction, and I think that continuing to, you know, work on the nuances of those products will keep them a mass market play. Apple's got to sort of shift, make sure that business is really healthy, maybe acquire. I am convinced that the Beats acquisition is really, really, it actually is about the hardware and those headphones that sell for these wild profit margins. And then focus its attention on developing new technologies in wearables and televisions. And I think it really, really needs that cushion of support.
Well, that's an incredibly insightful set of observations, Lindsay. And I completely agree with that. I think that there is I agree with you on the hardware part of it. You know, people always think about the technology, but think about the business. As we heard earlier in the program, you know, something you can make for $14, $15 and sell for $200, I don't care what you say. That's a great business. This acquisition pays for itself. The money is no object here. And again, they dominate the market for high end. So, you know, it's a great brand. I don't see, you know, I think the burden of proof, and here we're talking about Beats again, but the burden of proof is on the people who should have to say why they shouldn't buy it. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer to me. Well, in other news, an MIT researcher says that public awareness about the NSA's mass surveillance programs is causing self-censorship among internet users worldwide. Kind of an odd turn of events here. And with us to explain is Greg Fahrenstein, who's a technology journalist for VentureBeat. So can you tell us more about this research that you wrote about?
So I'm not entirely sure that it's causing much self-censorship. The article was, an MIT researcher says that some sensitive words, people are using them less. They're searching them online less with Google, and this is supposed to show that people are censoring themselves, what they write about, what they're emailing about, what else they're doing. They use Google Trends to show that things like dirty bomb, terrorist, and other words on the watch list for the government are being searched slightly less.
And so you don't think this is a significant chilling effect? Also, they talked about the increased use of DuckDuckGo as an alternative to Google because people are concerned about being surveilled. Do you attribute all of that that particular move to the NSA, or is that just a general awakening to the realities of the personal information being harvested?
The article I tried to write was, if we believe that self-censorship is a significant trade-off to surveillance, that is the ability of law enforcement to catch bad guys that may kill us, at what point do we start to care about self-censorship? The MIT researchers note there's about a 2.2% drop in keywords. So is that enough to care? It seems kind of small. If it was at 50%, would that be significant enough? It was at 0.0001%. Would that be significant enough? And when we start to quantify how things affect our lives, what is the value of one life or 10 lives saved versus the number of things we can talk about online?
I'm not convinced that self-censorship is necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if people are communicating over insecure networks, then it's rational and a positive thing if they're not, if they're too lazy to use encryption or whatever the, you know, the situation may be in each individual case. It makes sense and it's rational to self-censor if you think that people are eavesdropping on your conversations, which in fact they probably are unless you're taking extreme measures. Is this a positive thing to a certain extent? It's just, even though it's a small effect, wouldn't this indicate some measure of awareness that has been lacking traditionally that the internet is an insecure place?
I definitely think self-censorship is bad for democracy. I mean, you want a free flow of information. People have to feel comfortable expressing ideas and criticizing the government. And if the surveillance state is squelching that in any meaningful way, then it's a serious problem. But what we're seeing now is, you know, plenty of people are criticizing the NSA. I mean, everyone is, almost everyone. And so one of the main arguments against the surveillance state that people will self-censor doesn't seem to be carrying as much water. And while the MIT researchers seem to argue that, you know, people are self-censoring, I kind of took the opposite away from their study in that they're self-censoring at a rate of 2.2%. That doesn't strike me as significant.
It's also kind of interesting to think about what they're censoring, right? If they're censoring maybe some inappropriate things that they wouldn't want their spouse to know about, versus, you know, criticism of the government. And I think if we're down to 2.2%, that's, you know, the percentage of that is actually people censoring their opinions about the state is got to be pretty small. I would almost hope it would be more people speaking out against that.
I think the idea that we're living in a surveillance state that intimidates people is just, it's a little overblown. I mean, when you, every day you read the newspapers and people are just going after everyone at the National Security Agency. So it's hard to see some of the negative effects that people are worried about.
All right. Well, Greg Ferenstein, I want to thank you for calling in. It's an interesting article and it's interesting research, even if the effect is very, very small. It's a great conversation that we should all be having, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Now, Greg Ferenstein, is crunchgov.com a good URL for people to find you at?
You just find me Twitter handle, so at Ferenstein, Ferenstein. That's where I update people with big and mundane things.
Okay, fair enough. Your Twitter handle does have crunchgov.com on it, but people should instead just follow your Twitter feed. So thanks again for coming on.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right. Well, the California State Senate approved a bill last night to require a kill switch on all smartphones sold in the state. This bill is not quite a law yet, but it indicates a general trend toward the approval of kill switches. Lindsay Turrentine, what do you think of the kill switch? Should this be mandated by law, or is this something that should be chosen and selected by consumers and carriers?
Well, I think that's a tough one. I think that most consumers are not going to be engaged enough to know to turn it on. And I think that it's a hard to fall on either side of this argument, because there are going to be those people who are incredibly annoyed by having a kill switch implemented in an opt-out way. But I do think that practically speaking, it's probably the only way to stop the just rampaging cell phone theft that we're facing at this moment. I think in Oakland, 75% of personal theft is the stealing of mobile devices out of people's hands, largely.
And some additional details, 2,400 cell phones were stolen last year in San Francisco alone. That's a 23% increase from 2012. And nationwide, 3.1 million smartphones were stolen in the United States last year, up from 1.6 million. So I think the big news here, the big headline, is that it's a big source of crime and it's growing really fast. I know that the U.S. is probably catching up to Europe for the last 5 years or so. If you were seen walking around London with white earbuds, you were a target. And so smartphone thefts are huge. And the whole point of mandating it, as I understand it by law, is to enable criminals to know that every phone they might steal is protected by a kill switch. If it's voluntary, then they can roll the dice and steal it and find out if it, you know, it's right. It's still an open question. So it is an effective way to do that. The question is if it's the right thing or not. And it also has to be said that anything that happens in California is likely to be a de facto reality nationwide in the United States because so many Americans live in California. California's population, of course, is bigger than Canada. And I've heard statistics, I think it's 1 out of 8 Americans lives in the state of California. So if this passes, if Governor Jerry Brown passes this, it's expected that it could pass in August. That would be the timing of this. It still requires approval from the California State Assembly. But if everybody approves it and it goes into law in August, forget about it. This is a de facto reality in the United States, and carriers and smartphone makers will simply put kill switches into their devices that are sold for all of us. So everybody should be watching this. And if you care about kill switches, you want to pay attention to what's happening in the California state government.
Yeah, I also, it's worth noting that the New York Attorney General is also working really hard on this. And there's a lot of attention on this problem in New York as well. So once you add New York into that picture, then it's an even more compelling situation. And this passed very easily this time in the California State Senate. It had actually failed a couple weeks ago. And because it passed so easily, I think it's very likely to pass on the other side of the legislature in California. So, you know, I think understanding and equipping yourself with the understanding of how something like a kill switch works and knowing how to use it as soon as you get your phone with this kill switch enabled, if that indeed happens. And it probably won't happen. I think the new date is sometime in the spring or summer of 2015. So you won't be getting new phones with this on them until after that date. And then it would be quite some time until most people have a phone with the kill switch pre-installed, opt out, because, you know, all people hold on to their phones for a couple of years. But it would be good to understand how they work so that you know that if somebody steals your phone, you can brick it from wherever you are. And then as that action increases, thieves just give up, essentially.
Yeah, good information. Well, that's the tech news today. Lindsay Turrentine, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today and sharing your insights and your opinions and your facts. You're an encyclopedia of technology knowledge.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
All right. I really like having you on. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT, and we want you to do that. I encourage you to go there and subscribe to the audio or the video or both. But whatever you do, don't subscribe to neither. You should be subscribing to Tech News Today. Stay informed. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/TechNewsToday and follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. And you can subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. And we want to hear from you. So comment on Twitter or Google Plus using the hashtag TechNewsToday, all with no spaces. And send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific, tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.